What Burger King gets by going Canadian, the cost of starting the school day later, and we'll meet a Google doodler. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl, who's out reporting the next installment of our American Futures series. It's Monday, the 25th of August, and it's great to have you with us. Burger King may be the home of the Whopper, but where really is Burger King's home? Maybe not the U.S., if reports are true that it's in talks to acquire the Canadian donut company Tim Hortons and reincorporate north of the border. The fast food chain has been going through some big changes over the past few years, ever since a private equity firm bought it. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
The fast food industry is not the easiest place to be right now, even for a king.
The market is incredibly competitive.
Darren Tristano is executive vice president with Technomic. He says growth is very low, just about 3.5%. And inflation for the industry is also about 3.5%, so it's almost a wash. Low-income customers haven't seen wage growth, so they're holding on to their cash. Higher-income customers have been wooed by higher-end places like Chipotle and Panera. But if Burger King can't immediately control its customers' spending, it can control its own.
They have been cutting costs to free up resources. They've been running the business less like a restaurant and more like a financial company.
Burger King now lets franchisees operate all of its restaurants. It's aggressively tried to keep up with McDonald's on menu items. Charles Pinson Rose is with Standard & Poor's.
Overall, they've largely been successful. But I mean, the reality is it's a very difficult environment for quick service in the United States.
But acquiring Canadian firm Tim Hortons might help U.S. sales because Tim Hortons is good at coffee.
One of the categories that we have seen success in the restaurant space is the specialty coffee category.
RJ Hadavi is senior restaurant analyst with Morningstar. Coffee is gold for fast food profit margins.
This partnership strengthens Burger King's coffee offering.
It's another revenue stream. Of course, the tax benefits and easier access to cash abroad that Burger King gets with reincorporating in Canada can't hurt. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
The American Academy of Pediatrics joins a chorus that's been getting louder and louder. The school day, they say, should start later for teenagers because they aren't wired to go to bed early. And surprising no one, they need their sleep. The Academy says this is a public health issue. Sleep-deprived teens are more likely to crash cars, to get depressed and become obese. Also, they may not do as well in school. But the business of schooling means that early start times aren't likely to go away anytime soon. Here's Marketplace's Dan Weitzman.
From the outside, the economics of a later start time seem pretty good. Brian Jacob is an economics professor at the University of Michigan who studies education policy.
Among all the things that schools could do to improve student performance, this is one of the less expensive ones. I mean, this is not like hiring extra teachers to reduce class size or building a big new expensive building.
You do hear complaints about disruptions at the other end of the school day, kids getting home really late from sports practice or chess club, or not being able to work after-school jobs. But the big issue is transportation. That's what Chris Amundsen says. She's executive director of the National Association of State Boards of Education and a former member of the school board in Fairfax County, Virginia, which is like ground zero for debates on school start times. The debate started there when Amundsen was serving in the 1990s, and buses were the sticking point.
How school districts make school buses basically pay is that you use the equipment as much as you can.
Meaning, you run each bus multiple times every morning. Somebody's got to get picked up on the first run when it's still dark outside. Little kids get up early. Why not them?
Well, no, that was a non-starter. There were exactly zero of us that were prepared to have five-year-olds on the street in the dark.
Amundsen says late start times probably work better for smaller districts with fewer buses to run. Fairfax County's school board is scheduled to vote on a later start proposal this October. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders liked that Burger King news we talked about earlier. Details when we do the numbers. John G. Sperling has died. He was 93 years old, and if you haven't heard of him, you've probably heard of the school he founded, the for-profit University of Phoenix, which he said has served over 1 million people. Sperling's university has gotten plenty of criticism, in part for how much debt students took on and how few of them graduate. Emily Hanford is the education correspondent for American Radio Works, and she had the last interview with Sperling a couple of years ago. He spent part of that interview defending his school.
Traditional education has slammed the door. Where in the hell are you going to educate these people? Well, it's going to be places like the University of Phoenix, or they aren't going to be educated, period.
Hi, Emily.
Hi.
So you interviewed John Sperling when he was 91, and I should say 91 and proud of it.
Oh, yes, indeed. He was full of life at 91, that's for sure.
His life story is so fascinating. He grew up on a farm in the Ozarks and of course, became a billionaire. How did he get there? How did he come to start the school that became the University of Phoenix?
Yeah, as you mentioned, he grew up really poor. No one in his family had gone to college. He didn't think he was going to go to college. He became like a lefty. He was a socialist at one point. You know, he did what the University of Phoenix students do today. He went to class during the day, and he worked at a gas station at night, and he transferred to Reed College, an elite liberal arts school in Oregon. He went to Berkeley. He had two PhDs. He was just sort of this liberal, lefty humanities professor guy, and he ended up starting the University of Phoenix, one of the biggest for-profit universities, one of the biggest universities in the entire world.
How did the time he spent at Reed and at Cambridge and then as a humanities professor, as you say, sort of affect the pedagogy at the University of Phoenix? Did it influence it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was always a guy who was sort of on the outside looking in, and that was certainly true when he went to the kind of, you know, elite world of academia. He was kind of that working class guy who didn't fit in, and he really had a kind of a chip on his shoulder about traditional academia right from the very beginning, even though he benefited greatly from it. But he really saw that there was this whole group of people like him who didn't have access to this world of higher education. And that's really where the University of Phoenix idea came from.
And that's no small thing to start a school, to start a university. How quickly and how big did this thing grow?
Well, it started in 1976, and there were 8 students in 1976. And within
way earlier than I thought it would be. I mean, you think of University of Phoenix relying on the internet, doing a lot of online classes. This has been something that's been around for a while.
No. So the University of Phoenix had been chugging along, and it really wasn't in some ways what you might think of it now. Most of the people who were going there were working professionals. They were finishing bachelor's degrees, and they were really successful. They were paying out of pocket. They weren't getting financial aid. They weren't getting student loans. It wasn't about just learning for learning's sake. It was very much like, what do you need to learn to do your career better? What do you need to learn to get to the next step in your career? That's what we're going to teach people. And, you know, there was a lot of disdain for him from the very beginning because of that.
A pivotal moment in this company's history, and I say company because this was a for-profit corporation, is when it went public and the stock price really soared.
Yeah, absolutely. It went public and Wall Street loved it right away. And this was the early 90s. And then I think the big turning point came in the early 2000s when students at the University of Phoenix were now getting federal loans. They were using financial aid. And when they started to go in this market of associate degree seekers, they came up against this problem, which is people who are seeking associate's degrees tend to be less successful no matter where they go.
What did John Sperling say about that criticism? How did he react to it?
You know, when I interviewed him in his beautiful office in Phoenix, where he has like the collected works of Emily Dickinson on the bookshelves, you know, things like that. He's a real intellectual, and he was a socialist, as I mentioned before, but he has come to embrace the free market for sure. And when you ask him about the low completion rates, he flipped it around and said, "Well, a third of them are," and that's a third of people who wouldn't have otherwise had that opportunity. Now, that's the way he saw it, partly colored by the fact that he came from an era when that was probably more true, and he just turned it around and said, you know, it's about those success stories.
Emily Hanford is the education correspondent for American Radio Works. You can find a link to her documentary, The Rise of Phoenix, on our website. That's at marketplace.org. Thanks, Emily.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
The According to the Secret Service, more than 1,000 businesses have been infected with the same kind of malware that took down Target's computers earlier this year. And many of those businesses may have no idea this happened. So it seems there's no limit to the number of criminal hackers out there, but there is a severe shortage of cybersecurity professionals protecting us. Marketplace's Queena Kim looked around for a place where aspiring security experts are doing their training. She ended up in Las Vegas.
So money-wise, you can make anywhere between $100 and $150,000 for a security bug. And you can also get a job.
Prisa Tabriz is the engineering manager for the security team that protects Chrome, Google's web browser. And she's addressing a group of about 100 people at DEF CON. That's the hacker conference in Vegas. The conference is teeming with people who want to learn how to be cybersecurity specialists by learning how to break into computer systems. In other words, by learning to hack. There's even a kids track at DEF CON. It's called Roots.
Hi, my name is Kryptina. I am 12 years old.
What's your real name?
I can't say that, sorry.
Why not?
Because for privacy reasons.
I asked her, would you hack for Google?
Yeah, I definitely considered it. I've always wanted to be like a computer scientist or a forensic scientist.
You could call it a recruiting trip.
That's Tabriz from Google. She's saying that tongue-in-cheek. She's mostly here to teach kids hacking. But she says there's truth to the joke. Google does have a program that pays hackers to report security bugs.
We run a couple of vulnerability reward programs at Google, and there's a lot of kids that are underage and find bugs or contribute to this code.
And Tabriz says she's hired one of those kids. He started submitting bugs when he was around 12, and she kept track of him. She says that doesn't happen very often at Google, but that it happens at all illustrates the severe shortage of cybersecurity experts in tech.
It's really amazing because nowadays you could get a job without a high school degree for six figures if you know how to hack.
That's Nico Sell. She's a co-founder of Roots. She says there are a couple reasons for the shortage in cybersecurity. Mobile computing, apps, and the Internet of Things has given rise to criminal hackers who can now break into almost every part of our lives. At the same time, universities are failing to train cybersecurity professionals, which is why so many people go to DEF CON.
Something that my parents get a little upset about me saying, but I do believe in this strongly, is that this education that I've received at DEF CON is way more valuable than my Ivy League education by 10 times.
Companies that are looking for cybersecurity talent say, in part, that's because the basic curriculum for computer engineering degrees was set about 50 years ago, and it teaches students to build systems instead of breaking into them. Two universities are trying to change that, Cleveland State University and nearby Case Western.
Hi, my name is Saurabh Bunia.
Professors like Saurabh Bunia have started teaching students how to break into computer systems.
It's basically an approach of hacking for credit.
Bunia says the approach is controversial. Hacking can be illegal, and lots of universities aren't comfortable teaching it. He says the debate boils down to this.
Is it ethical to teach hacking to our students?
Lots of schools have decided it isn't ethical, and so they teach the theory behind hacking instead. But Bunia says unless students know how to hack into computer systems, it's nearly impossible for them to figure out how to defend them.
They take these theoretical courses and then go to these companies. They're not capable of understanding the different security vulnerabilities, and they're also not capable of coming up with solutions.
Bunia hopes Case Western's program will convince universities that teaching hacking is vital to any cybersecurity program. But until universities make that change, people who want to work in cybersecurity are relying on hackathons and conferences like DEF CON to learn the real-world skills they need to keep us safe.
You could break in to their account.
And they're starting earlier and earlier. In Las Vegas, I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Even software engineers who you think might be diametrically opposed to artists, they really take the same creative passion in their work that we do.
Google has cybersecurity experts. It also has doodlers. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 75 points, 0.4% to close at 17,076. The NASDAQ advanced 18 points, 0.4% to end the day at 4557. and the S&P 500 was up 9 points, about a half percent, to finish at 1997, a record close, though below the 2,000 points level it crossed earlier in the day. Mergers made the news. Burger King chomped up almost 20%. As we set the top, the U.S. fast food giants in talks to buy Tim Hortons. The Canadian coffee chain frothed up 19% on the news. In Europe, Britain's FTSE dropped just a tad. France's CAC 40 was up 2%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.38. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its numbers on orders for durable goods for the month of July. Things like machinery and washing machines. On this day in 1818, the U.S. welcomed Illinois as the 21st state of the Union. And give your dog a bone, a cuddle, and a treat. It's National Dog Day. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. Last night at the Video Music Awards, Miley Cyrus's song Wrecking Ball won Video of the Year. But she didn't give an acceptance speech. Instead, Cyrus's date, a young homeless man who gave his name as Jesse, accepted the award on her behalf. Instead of thanking producers, he talked about the problem of homeless youth in Los Angeles. And he asked viewers to visit Miley Cyrus's Facebook page, where there's a link to donate to a nonprofit called My Friend's Place. Sally Herships reports on what the celebrity spotlight can do for a nonprofit.
So here's how it feels to run the nonprofit Miley Cyrus promoted last night on national television.
Today's been a little bit of a whirlwind. You know, it actually even started last night.
Heather Carmichael is executive director of My Friend's Place, a nonprofit that supports homeless youth in Hollywood. She says as of this morning, $70,000 in donations had come in. How does that compare to a typical 24-hour period?
Coming into this kind of opportunity is really out of the ordinary and ever so extraordinary.
Carmichael says the money could go to anything from providing more food to longer hours. But if you're a nonprofit, what should you do with a sudden spike in donations? Jeff Shuck, CEO of Plenty, a consulting firm that helps nonprofits raise money, says stop and think about the money.
That's an aberration. It's a windfall. It's not something that can be easily replicated.
Shuck says one trap is for nonprofits to make long-term decisions, like hiring new staff, based on a one-time shot of income. He says organizations should think about saving and improving infrastructure.
We can't change the world unless we can turn the lights on. We can't make a difference to other people in our lives unless we have desks and papers and computers.
And what about the strategy of using a celebrity to raise money? Trevor Nielsen is co-founder of Global Philanthropy. He's a friend who advised Cyrus on how to promote My Friend's Place.
Really, it comes down to a combination of both raising awareness but also raising funds.
Nielsen says even a celebrity-oriented campaign that doesn't raise money isn't a success. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say there's a good chance you're stuck in traffic right now. As more people move to cities, as urban populations get bigger, it's getting harder and harder to get around in a car. Now, a lot of cities could compete for the title of the city with the worst traffic: Bangkok, Los Angeles, Washington. But today, we go to Calcutta. Here's the BBC's Rahul Tandon.
I'm standing on a busy street here in Calcutta. With me, I've got Sumit Arora, who's living in Calcutta at the moment, but he's also lived in the Middle East and also in Malaysia. And we're going to get into the car and go for a drive to see how bad traffic is in this city.
The worst, I think, in India, comparatively to the other cities.
What strikes me is you have to deal with cars, you have to deal with rickshaws, you have to deal with trucks, buses, and lots of people who will walk on the road, but not on the pavement.
Absolutely. That's the old, you know, this is a very strange part about Calcutta, which I only see in Calcutta, where people don't walk on the pavement and they walk on the road.
Let's go and get in the car. Here we are. We're stuck behind a truck. How long can you be stuck here sometimes?
Could be from anywhere from 15 minutes to an hour.
When you're stuck in a car, what do?
Listen to music, smoke a cigarette.
You beeped your horn. Does it make any difference?
No, not.
So why do people do it?
It's a part of an Indian culture, honking. If I had driven overseas, I would never honk. But in India, it's traditional to honk. It makes you feel superior.
Well, honk away, because we're not going anywhere at the moment. So I'm out of the car, stuck in the traffic, but there is somebody in front of me with a scooter, Manjit Singh Hujan. Scooters make a lot of sense in Calcutta.
Oh, yes, they do. They cut down transit time in half. The commuting time kind of gets doubled and more on a car.
I mean, what do you do when you're stuck in a traffic jam?
Thanks to cell phones and smartphones and Facebook, I generally sort of update myself as to what my other friends stuck in traffic jams are doing. We friends have this common joke, you know. I mean, we wonder if the parking attendant would come and say, hey, $10, you know, you've been here for long. You never know.
So Manjit can get on his scooter and disappear. Sumit's car is still stuck there. So I'm actually near an economist's office, Mudo Pattaraya, so I'm going to go and speak to him and find out what impact these traffic problems have on business in this city.
People don't appreciate that, you know, spending about a couple of hours on road is unproductive. I mean, what do you do in a car? Nothing. Just look out and probably appreciate the traffic, which I think is absolutely economically ridiculous.
I've been back in the car with Sumit for a while now. It's stuck in traffic for a good half an hour.
I can't stand it anymore.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to leave you in the car, and I think I'm going to go and walk. So, bye-bye, Sumit. And if you are coming to Calcutta, the advice is simple. Maybe walk. It's quicker than being in a car. In Calcutta, I'm the BBC's Rahul Tandon for Marketplace.
The Burning Man Festival kicks off today, and I mention this because back in August of 1998, Google's co-founders went to that festival, and they changed the Google logo on Google's homepage when they were gone. They put a little Burning Man stick figure behind one of the O's in the company's name. Well, that was the first Google Doodle. Today, Google has a whole team of employees who design those images at the top of its homepage, commemorating birthdays, big events. Today's doodle was created by Sophia Foster Domino. She's a Google doodler, and she joins us now to talk about what her job entails. Hey there, Sophia.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So let's start with today's doodle. I opened it up. There's an African-American woman. It's an animation. She's hitting a tennis ball. What are we looking at here?
So this is a doodle celebrating Althea Gibson, who is one of the greatest tennis athletes of all time. Before I worked on the doodle, I didn't actually know about her. She's very well known in the tennis community, but not to the world at large. So I was really happy to be able to illustrate her playing tennis and sort of reintroduce her to the world, I guess.
So that begs the question, you know, where the ideas for these come from? You hadn't heard of her before. How did it come to be that you would do this doodle?
So for the first several years that doodles were sort of an operation, we did doodles that I guess were more freebies, like, you know, Leonardo da Vinci or Einstein, people that, you know, everyone has heard of. As time has gone on, we have sort of wanted to broaden our reach. We know that in the course of history, certain people are not as well remembered as they should be. So we've sort of taken it upon ourselves to dig a little deeper, try and find people that have maybe fallen out of the spotlight and let them share the stage with these other, you know, famous individuals that we celebrate.
I think there'll be a lot of artists and illustrators listening, sort of wondering how you came to get this job. What's your background and how did you end up working for Google there in Mountain View?
So I went to the Rhode Island School of Design. I graduated in 2010 with a degree in illustration. And one of my coworkers now was a year ahead of me at RISD and came back for a portfolio review. And she liked my work then, and that's how I got recruited. But we have, you know, people from all over the country, people who have a history in the animation industry or in children's book illustration. I think that doodles unite people from very different artistic backgrounds because it's sort of a celebration of creative and scientific fields in general. So there's something for everyone.
What is it like to be an artist working for a big tech company? Was it a sort of seamless integration for you, or is it at times difficult?
It was a bit interesting. Tech employees, you know, are very data-driven, but I think the surprising thing I found after getting acclimated was that even software engineers who you think might be diametrically opposed to artists, they really take the same creative passion in their work that we do.
Let me just ask you lastly about the top secretness of these things. When I found out I was going to be doing this interview, there's an embargo on it. I wasn't allowed to tell anyone about it. You guys keep these under close wraps.
Yeah, because as I said, one of the main appeals of doodles is that they're a total surprise. You don't know what you'll see every day when you come to the homepage. It's sort of like a, you know, a secret present or like a surprise party.
some users have noticed that if it's your birthday and you're signed into Gmail, if you go to the Google homepage, you'll see a doodle just for your birthday.
I didn't know that.
Which has never failed to surprise and delight people. But yeah, we have a lot planned, but our plans change pretty regularly, which means it's also sometimes a surprise for us what we'll be doing in a few months. But that sort of excitement is part of what makes the job so fun.
Sophia Foster-Domino is an illustrator based in San Francisco. She's also a Google doodler. Sophia, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
This final note, 200 years ago yesterday, the British burned down the White House. And that was a big moment in the War of 1812, which you know all about if you've listened to public radio regularly. Anyway, the British Embassy marked the anniversary yesterday. There was a cake, a big cake in the shape of the White House. And this being 2014, the British Embassy tweeted a picture of it with the caption, "Only sparklers this time." Well, plenty of people seem to take umbrage at that, including a spokesperson for the State Department. She tweeted about the special relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. Hashtag, it's complicated. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. I'm David Gura. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.